listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest this week is Yuval Sharon, founder and co-artistic director of the industry in Los Angeles, and currently the Gary L. Wasserman Artistic Director of Detroit Opera. Yuval Sharon has amassed an unconventional body of work that expands the operatic form, and he is probably the most productive person I know. In the 2023-24 season alone, he will present a new site-specific production of John Cage's Your Operas 3 and 4 from 1990, staged with Detroit Opera in the historic Gem Theater in March 2024. A revival of his Cleveland Orchestra production of Janáček's The Cunning Little Vixen, staged with Detroit Opera in May 2024, and his cult classic Die Zauberflöte at Staatsoper Berlin throughout the season. Sharon made his debut with Detroit Opera in 2020 with Twilight Gods, an innovative adaptation of Wagner's Götterdämmerung, staged in the Detroit Opera House Parking Center, and with Lyric Opera of Chicago at the Millennium Lakeside Parking Garage. Since then, he has directed a number of acclaimed productions with the company, including Puccini's La Bohème, presented in reverse order in the Detroit Opera House, and The Valkyries, an adaptation of Act III of Die Walküre, first staged with the Los Angeles Philharmonic in the Hollywood Bowl, which used green screen technology and projection screens to bring Wagner's proto-cinematic vision to life in real time. Beyond his own productions, Sharon's artistic guidance has transformed the company into a premier destination for progressive opera in the United States. Highlights from his tenure as artistic director include a major revival of Anthony Davis's X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, directed by Robert O'Hara, in a production with Lyric Opera of Chicago, the Metropolitan Opera, Opera Omaha, and Seattle Opera, and its first international co-production, Osvaldo Golishov's Inadimar, directed by Deborah Kolker, with Opera Ventures, Scottish Opera, Welsh National Opera, and the Metropolitan Opera. With the industry, Sharon has directed and produced new operas in moving vehicles, operating train stations, Hollywood sound stages, and various non-spaces, such as warehouses, parking lots, and escalator corridors. Between 2016 and 2019, Sharon was the first artist collaborator at the Los Angeles Philharmonic, creating 9 projects that included newly commissioned works, site-specific installations, and performances outside the hall. His residency also included a splendid production of John Cage's Your Operas 1 and 2 from 1985 to 1987 in the Sony Sound Studio in Studio City, and it culminated in a new production of Meredith Monk's opera Atlas, making him the first director Monk entrusted with her work. Other recent work from Sharon includes a new production of Monteverdi's Orfeo, presented at Santa Fe Opera in summer 2023. In March 2023, Sharon assembled and directed the world premiere production of Proximity, a collection of 3 new operas by Daniel Bernard Romain, Carolyn Shaw, and John Luther Adams with Lyric Opera of Chicago. I first met Yuval in John Cage's centennial year, 2012, when he was first engaged by Michael Tilson Thomas to direct a newly staged version of Cage's songbooks from 1970, first for the San Francisco Symphony and later in February 2013 for the New World Symphony in Miami, the latter in a marvelous festival conceived by MTT entitled Making the Right Choices. Yuval's stellar cast for songbooks included none other than Meredith Monk, Joan LaBarbera, and Jesse Norman, as well as Michael Tilson Thomas himself. Now we're readying ourselves for Sharon's Your Operas 3 and 4, Cage's second opera, this time mounted in Detroit's historic Gem Theater, March 8, 9, and 10. Yuval describes this work as, quote, made entirely of recycled materials, arias that everyone is familiar with, classics from the European repertoire. The only catch, he continues, is that they're all performed at the same time. Through chance operations, singers will perform arias that they select, while pianists play transcriptions of different operas, and the phonographs are playing different recordings. The result is something new and original, an exhilarating, bewildering, wonderful work. There are many experiences happening simultaneously, more similar to an installation, or like when you came to the Michigan Theater to see Bliss in 2021. It does not have to adhere to our standard ideas of narrative or experience. It can be so many different things, a true collage of things we know and love. Yuval is smart, funny, inquisitive, and insightful. And let's hope he makes good on his promise to do the third and last of Cage's operas, Year Opera 5 from 1991, and soon. So welcome to All Things Cage, Yuval. It's great to be with you.
I am so delighted to be here and excited to be with you, Laura. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I don't think I've seen you since you did Year Operas 1 and 2.
Yeah, and that was already 5 years
six.
Ago.
Actually. Going on six, right?
Going on six.
2018?
Going on six. Oh, yes, I know. A while ago. Yeah, but we've been friends since the John Cage songbooks that I did at San Francisco Symphony.
Yes, I speak about that in your introduction, which you were not privy to.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Right. I mean, as I say in the introduction, the songbooks with Michael Tilson Thomas and New World Symphony was just marvelous. It was exactly right.
Thank you so much. I mean, that was such a great experience for me because it was my first time actually working with Cage's music directly. You know, up until then, I read Silence in college and then became absolutely crazy about Cage's writing. But I felt like I didn't have a lot of access to Cage performances. So I felt like it was somewhat abstract for me, what Cage was all about. There was only one experience that I had when I was living in Berlin where they did a big Cage kind of it was a huge event called Simultaneous Silence. I don't know, Laura, were you part of that at all?
I don't think so. Keep going and I'll see if it rings the bell.
Yeah, it was this incredible event that took place in an old DDR radio station that was kind of abandoned. And they had, it was a 12-hour day with performances round the clock in different rooms of this radio station. And there was one room where all of the performances were simultaneously streamed, audio streamed. And it was called Simultaneous Silence. And that's probably as close as I came, you know, to really engaging with the music in real time and the pieces in real time. So when I was asked to do the songbooks, it just was such an amazing experience in actually engaging with the ideas of Cage and realizing how many things I thought about Cage were wrong. You know, like I had so many misconceptions that I think are also somewhat cultural. You know, I think when we think about Cage, there's a lot of things that we think about that don't feel right anymore. So I somehow associated him a lot with improvisation. And then I just realized, I'm like, no, improvisation actually does not have very much to do with Cage, actually.
It's kind of the opposite in a weird way. It's not that he disliked improv, because a lot of people believe that. And it's not true at all. He didn't like any kind of improvisation that would result in something that you could foresee.
Yes.
But he wanted you to, always to be experimental in what you were doing when you create something.
Well, I really valued that when I was working on it, because I realized that actually the way that improvisation tends to work when you are in a jazz combo or some other kind of musical form is you actually want to listen to each other and you want to lean into what the other person's doing. So if someone else is riffing on something and that inspires you, then then everyone kind of ratchets themselves up, you know? And if the inspiration isn't there, then the improvisation can kind of fall flat too, you know? Like that's the risk of it, right?
Do you work with improvisation a lot with the industry?
I do, actually. I really do. And it's a lot of that is because of Cage, you know, realizing that not because of how improvisation or improvisational ideas or things related to improvisation show up in Cage, but more because when I did do the songbooks, I started to realize just how much electricity there is in the kind of performances that are different from the standard classical performance and the traditional opera in which everything is worked out within an inch of its life and there is no spontaneity. And you know, and there's just a it's it can feel like a really closed room with no oxygen in it. And when I did the songbooks, you know, even though we ended up really setting everything that we did, you know, and we really encouraged everyone to stick to your timeline and stick to what you're doing, and don't improvise because that could really mess something up. But I mean, that spirit of openness and generosity, that is so a part of anything that I've seen that's been a John Cage event or a happening. I just really wanted to bring that back into the more standard operatic apparatus, you know? And I think a part of that has been about introducing improvisation to it as something that throws off the rigidity, you know?
Right. You've also done, you've all, and just rereading, I know a lot about you already, but just kind of rereading in preparation for today. You've done a lot of things in your life that were very cagey in that way. For example, your use of strange places to stage things. That's a kind of improvisation in and of itself because you're putting your players in spaces that they don't inhabit other than to go get their car or get
Absolutely.
up to their doctor's appointment or whatever it is,
Well, thank you. I absolutely agree that I don't know if I would have been as interested in those kind of liminal in-between spaces in our social sphere if it wasn't for my engagement with Cage, because so much of the experience of working on Cage for me has been about training myself to pay attention to the things I normally don't pay attention to, you know, and sort of saying that these are things I have conditioned myself to kind of ignore, you know, like this is, or saying that's not music, or this is pretty, this is ugly, you know, this is a nice sound, this is an unpleasant sound, this is a, you know, that engaging with Cage's ideas means that unbelievable democratization of sounds and spaces, and realizing that there is art and beauty and life everywhere, but we need to train ourselves to see it, you know?
Right. There's a beautiful Cage quote that you might enjoy relative to what you just said. And the Cage quote is, if we give up beauty, what have we got?
I
And
mean,
it's
that's
just,
so right. I mean, it's so right. And I think that that's when I encounter people that are experiencing Cage for the first time, I really try to tell them it's not about discordance. It's not about anything. There are moments that are discordant potentially, but it's not purposefully done. It's not done to be abrasive. It's not done to do. It is done with a sense that everything's beautiful, actually. And
That's exactly right. That's
you know,
exactly right.
there's another Cage quote that I'm sorry to say that I can't recall off the top of my head, but you probably know this, but there's something that really always resonated with me that I believe is in Silence, where he somewhere among the collected essays in Silence, where he says, you know, there is beauty all around us, and theater's job, I'm pretty sure he really specified theater, actually, theater's job is just to make us alert to that fact. You know, I have to find it. Maybe I'm surprised. I wish you know, getting prepared for your operas 3 and 4, I should really have it at the ready. But
Oh no, that's okay. There's so much data and so much information with
I
him,
know.
and so many quotes out there that
Oh,
are so wonderful.
they really, really are. But I feel like that's such a big part of the Cagean mission that I really re resonated with. And I think to your point, you know, it suddenly became about, what if we did operas in places that people have designated as what they call non-places, right? These are the places that the kind of commercialization of the social sphere have rendered characterless, you know, have given us a feeling like we just, you know, we just go through these spaces and we leave no imprint on them, and they leave no imprint on us. And these are the
Right.
spaces that
Like
actually,
parking centers, like parking centers.
exactly.
It's a perfect example.
Right. And then realizing that actually introducing, you know, this layer of performance into a space that otherwise has a kind of everyday quality to it does help us tune our attention to what's really happening in that space.
And I
So.
think it's really super important that your players are the people that are, they're on the front line of that experience,
That's
because
right.
they're performing in space that they normally just move through with blinders on. They just really never really think about it or look at it.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And you know, we're all guilty of that. I mean, it's partially just inhabiting this world, is you do start to, you know, you do start to concentrate, you know what I mean? In a way that, meaning like, you know, you have this kind of concentric view on reality, right? Which is like, I'm going to zero in on what I need, which is I need to get from point A to point B, and I'm then going to filter out everything that kind of does that stands in the way of getting from point A to point B, which
Yeah,
means you're still
absolutely,
traveling,
absolutely.
you know?
You know, and for our listening audience, it might be interesting to know that that festival that you've all produced or directed the songbooks in Miami was Michael Pilson Thomas's baby at New World Symphony. And he's a lovely guy, just
Yes,
lovely.
indeed, indeed. It
But
was
he named that festival Making the Right Choices. And I thought that was so pointed because, you know, Michael, more than anybody, was, you know, knows that, you know, all of it is choice. You know, even if you're choosing the most wildly indeterminate space to work in, you know, you're making right choices. Just to say something like we that society had it a little bit backwards, that you should have laws where you need them. And if you don't need them, you don't have them. You just don't have them.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about, and I've been wanting to talk to you about this actually. I've been thinking a lot about how John Cage was related to notions of anarchy. And I don't mean anarchy the way that we tend to think about anarchy, meaning lawlessness and like utter lawlessness, like gleeful crime. You know what I mean? Like, I think we have a very, very negative opinion about anarchy. And I'm actually starting to sense that socially we are shifting our opinion towards anarchy and actually starting to see a lot of the value in what it means to not be in such a rigid social structure that never changes, you know? And so I'm
Right.
seeing a lot of, you know, political theorists and thinkers that are really starting to see some of the generative ideas that are inside anarchy. And I actually have to say that I have been meaning to kind of do my own research on how John Cage has been thinking about anarchy, because I feel like when you see a John Cage performance, you actually are getting the essence of what an society that is anarchically organized, let's say, know? Like, what does that feel like? It's not lawless. It's just about interdependence, the great John Cage.
Right. Interdependence is a good way to think about it, but it's also about self-governance. It's about if every single person took it upon themselves to govern themselves in the way that they believe is right and just and fair and moral and all of that, you would have a kind of naturally anarchic situation. When Cage was writing his, I think it was the Harvard lectures, and he wanted to bring together, or it might have been his piece called Anarchy. There is a book of Masaustic poems where he takes all the famous anarchists in the world and brings them, makes hamburger out of all of their texts and then spews them back out in these beautiful Masaustic poems. So you can get that book, but
Gotta find that. Thank you.
it's really, and it talks about the source text. But all I was going to bring up, and maybe I'll link to this in our broadcast page, and I'll certainly send it to you if you want it. It's he solicited, he posed the question of what is anarchy today? What is it today? To a self-proclaimed anarchist, the wife of Tom Johnson, the music critic.
Wasn't he a composer too, or am I got that wrong?
Yes, totally. Oh no, totally. He's a
That's what I thought.
wonderful composer.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I'm gonna go
Well,
actually.
his wife's name is Esther Ferrer. And
Right.
so Cage wrote to Esther in Paris, they live in Paris, and said, "What is anarchy today? What is it?" She wrote him back the most beautiful letter, but it's online. If you just type in anarchy, Esther Ferrer's letter to John Cage.
Well, thank you. I'm going to absolutely look at that, because I've been more interested in anarchy as a social phenomenon. Again, not in the sense of free for all, social free for all. But I like you said that there is, and you know, trying to distinguish between self-governance and a libertarian kind of mindset, right? Which is just like it's me versus everybody. You know, it's like with
Right.
Cage, she's really showing the opposite, which is like that there is self-governance, but you still are responsible for everybody. So like a performer in a Cage piece needs to be self-sufficient, right? And has a timeline, has the thing that they are doing, and they have to be so immersed in what they are doing that they should know anything else could happen around you, and it cannot get you off your track, and you must not
Right,
listen
right.
to what anyone's doing, right?
Yes.
And
Cage
yet,
used to, I'm trying to think, when he did Your Operas 1 and 2 for Frankfurt in 19, whatever it was, 87, 88, when it premiered, he would instruct his performers to rehearse in a house with a radio playing,
Yes,
in the living room with the television on, maybe the sound off, but the radio's on, that to just put all these things in your way and practice just being in your own center. And I think that really helps people a great deal.
That's great. Yeah, that's a great tidbit of advice that I'll give to our Your Operas 3 and 4 cast
Yeah,
because
just tell them to just do that, for a couple of hours a day for 2 or 3 days,
okay, I definitely will. That's a great suggestion, especially for our, we have such a great cast for Your Operas 3 and 4. The Your Operas 3 cast, is a, skews kind of like young, they're kind of earlier in their career for the most part. And I think are like sponges and are excited about this challenge. We've been preparing them with kind of Zoom meetings leading up to it and letting them know what the philosophical ideas behind this experience is. But it's been so wonderful working with Susan Graham, who's going to do Your Operas 4, who is, one of the great mezzo sopranos of our time. And I really had to call back on working with the great Jesse Norman on the songbooks, because this was obviously a kind of
For
new.
our audience, he worked with Jesse Norman on the songbooks
Yeah,
in
well.
Miami for the MTT, Making the Right Choices. It was part of Cage's centennial, actually, although which was 2012, but it didn't happen until February of 2013. So it
Yeah,
was
but in
the very last thing
yeah.
in the centennial programming.
Well, in San Francisco and at Carnegie did coincide with the 2012 centennial, which was really nice, but also was great for us to have multiple goes at it. So the cast was just the perfect mix of three incredible vocalists. We had Joan LaBarbara, who's so well versed in Cage, and who for someone like me that was doing Cage for the first time was just such an invaluable partner, because she
Sure.
really, really knew the material. And so I could run ideas by her and she would be like, that doesn't sound very Cagean, like maybe you should go look at this, maybe you should go look at this text from Cage and then realize that maybe your idea isn't quite right. She was always so wonderful about
Yeah,
that,
she's also a natural teacher, isn't she?
Exactly. No, I felt very like I felt, and also watching her navigate this world was for me also my unbelievable example for everybody, as to how to make this happen. And then there was Meredith Monk, who had met Cage and had very, very fond memories of engaging with Cage, and I think has recorded Aria.
She recorded many things of Cage's, but they were really good friends. She probably underplays that a little bit. Cage was very fond of her.
There was a fondness there, but Meredith was really, like this was also kind of new territory for her. She kind of says, I don't normally do other people's music, so for her, so she had a, different way that she was kind of inside and outside, whereas Joan was really inside, like she really knew the material from inside. And then the third soprano was Jesse Norman, who
I
was
know, I know.
completely new to this, right? It's
It was so exciting for us, for those of us who, had watched the likes of Joan LaBarbara and Meredith Monk. People like that are so wonderful because they knew that work. And we were so excited because of, not because of Jessie Norman's fame or her talent or anything like that, just that she was a newcomer to this family, and it was so exciting to watch her.
It was so wonderful to watch her navigate this world. You know what I mean? And sort of realize that she has to adjust the way that she performs. You can imagine someone already who has graced the stage of every major opera stage in the world,
For decades and decades,
for decades, and suddenly just kind of asked to say there is so much grace and beauty in you just sitting at the typewriter and writing a letter to your loved one. And you don't have to do anything. You don't have to perform it. You don't have to, you are just there. And then you'll perform the next thing. It was a challenge for her, but it was also amazing to watch. I mean, she was such a truly consummate artist because she really wanted to get at the heart of what Cage was trying to do and align herself with that, as opposed to doing her own kind of vanity project. Do you know what I mean? Like she was.
No, I do totally. I do. One of my favorite things that came out of that festival and out of songbooks in that festival was the videos that were captured of MTT, Michael Tilson Thomas. I keep saying just MTT, but Michael Tilson Thomas and Jesse Norman together. They did,
Oh,
Now
sure.
at the Pond Knocked. They did The Wonderful Widow. They did all these things where Michael, who's a wonderful pianist, is just tapping on the piano, and there's Jesse singing. And it
Right.
was so elegant to
Oh,
watch
I love
the two
that.
of them. I just thought it was so beautiful. And those, some of those are still online.
Oh, I've got to see those. Yeah, I've got to see
Yeah,
them.
if you just type in MTT and Jesse Norman, I think a couple of them come up for you to watch.
Oh, amazing. Okay, thanks for that tip. I want to relive that moment for sure.
Yeah, me
I
too.
really
I
want to
do
relive that
every
moment.
now and then because they're just so, she's such a consummate performer that it's just incredible to watch her bring that, oh, I don't know, the operatic tradition of performance to
Absolutely.
Paige's music. It was breathtaking, you know, because.
Couldn't agree more. And I think that's what led me to really want to have that same quality of someone who is such a seasoned opera performer who has performed, all over the world, now turning their attention to Cage, so I really wanted, that's why I really wanted someone like Susan Graham. And it was amazing that Susan was willing to take this leap. And for her, it is a challenge, and she admits it. She says, and it's been a great conversation though. And she's now really, really pumped. We're going to start rehearsal next week.
Yeah,
But
marvelous.
she, it really took her a moment to say, the first thing she said is, I have such reverence for this material. And so this is really hard for me because I'm suddenly, so much is stripped away. And I said, well, I have to say that actually, I don't find this irreverent at all. I actually find it beautifully reverent. It's actually, we love this material. So, I mean, I sense that Cage loved this music in a way, like that he actually really thought the music was beautiful, the singing style was beautiful, but it's, the way that opera is usually presented is so rigid and so closed and so, repetitive. We just do the same arias over and over again with very little variation. And
Right.
to really try and find what is, what un what can we uncover, that's in this material, that needs a whole new approach to listening to it for us to really get at, maybe on one hand, maybe to get at the heart of what's happening in this music,
Right,
but
right.
just also just hear it and let them be the basic building blocks of something brand new. I find that an act of actual of love for the music as opposed
Oh,
to.
no, I think you're absolutely right. I think, but I think he was also in love with the whole notion of transformation, of creating something and putting it in a context that it turns it into something else. You know, it makes it larger. It makes it more
Absolutely.
relevant to you. It, you know, the first time I saw your operas 1 and 2, I couldn't believe the number of exclamations from the audiences. You know, the kind of aha factor of it. Oh, that was that's. And then they're on to something else, but you know, it was
Right.
magic flute. It was Matt Henry. It was magic flute. Did you hear it? You know, and it was really sweet to see them engaging with it in that way. You know.
Oh, I mean, that must have been really wonderful because, yeah, it my experience, I first saw your operas 1 and 2 at the Ruhr Triennale, in the
Yeah.
Herbal production. It's the first time I had ever seen them. And I remember going to see it and realizing at some point that, I think I came in with a sense of, I wonder what I'll recognize. I wonder what I'll know. Like, it almost as if it was like a quiz on how much opera I could, And then I think about maybe 15 or 20 minutes in, I realized that that was an absolute dead end. Like that was, in a way, a affirmation of self knowledge, or like the knowledge that I, excuse me, that's affirmation.
No, I get it. I totally get
What I
that.
mean,
Yeah.
like to me, that's like the exact opposite of the Cagean enterprise and
It's
the
also, isn't it? It's something that actually blocks experience because you're so focused on,
That's right.
you know, one thing.
Yeah, there's like such a, and I'm writing about this in my upcoming book, that's coming out in September, that actually, and this really does get in the way of so much operatic experience, which is the idea that, we are looking for confirmation of what we already know when we go to the opera, which means like, oh, I know how La Bohème goes. I know how it's supposed to look. I know how it's supposed to sound. I know all, this is all things I know. And then when I go to a performance, I kind of go and say, ah, yes, check. Or, oh, no, I know better. I know better
Right,
than how this goes.
right.
And there is an arrogance there, and there is an elitism in that kind of mentality. But more importantly, I just want to tell people, you're not engaging anymore with in front of you. It's you're actually kind of engaging with your own experience and your own memory, as opposed to the artists that are right in front of you, the production that might make some might take some liberties, you know.
You thought that also takes us back to what you were talking about before, about this business about improvisation. Didn't want the performer to be thinking, oh, I like this lick a lot that I do. I'm going to do it now because it'll sound good. And it
Right.
takes you out of the experience of what you're
Right.
doing.
Yeah,
And he
yeah.
was interested in creating situations for performers where they actually couldn't do that. They literally couldn't do it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think I realized when I did the songbooks that it's actually really wonderful to not rehearse them too much, you know, because
Oh.
the more you get, the more you rehearse it, the more you start to this, then the performer starts to get kind of cocky, you know, they start to realize, okay, I know what I'm doing. And oh, last time I did this, people laughed. So this time
That's
I'm gonna
right.
kind of
That's right.
overdo it.
That's
You know what
right.
I mean? Like
That's right.
this
So
time
you're just like
I want that
always,
laugh again. I want someone to respond to me,
always,
you know? And
always.
so there's part of it that for that I've taken into account now as we do your operas 3 and 4, that everyone's a little on edge, actually, because we haven't started rehearsal yet. So this is a really wonderful precarious moment in the process, because most people go, what is this going to be? You know, and you realize that so many artists come into a process with basically already a pretty clear idea of what it is, right? And then basically either those expectations are confirmed and they feel quite satisfied, or those expectations are not met. Like, you know, maybe the director was not as prepared as they should have been, or maybe the conductor ended up speeding right through the aria that they practiced a very different way, or, you know, all of those things. But in this case, they're coming in and there's no way they know what to expect, you know?
Right, because it's not the context is so different than anything they've ever done as a performer if they haven't done Cage, because so much Cage, as you well know now, through all the things you've done, really, not just the your operas, but you know, a lot of it is collage, a lot of it is
Right.
over things overlaid, you know.
Right. Right.
And so a lot of it is for the performer a new way of performing, a new way of being in an ensemble, a new way of just being with another performer on the stage. It's just different.
Absolutely. It's like, and it is so different for artists that are used to a kind of realistic music theater, you know, where you are now interacting with an artist. You know, your fellow artist in a way that's really transactional, you know, like I'm giving you this and I need this and blah, 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 you know. And in this case, you really just have to be with other people, you know, and you
Right. You're just
just
being
have to
you
share
and they're
space.
just being them.
Exactly.
And seeing what happens. I guess all I was wanted to say, Yuval, is that you are, in my experience, maybe not the only person, but close to the only person who has ever taken on your operas 1 and 2 and then taken on your operas 3 and 4. So tell us the difference for you. I mean, obviously they're different in the size of those works, but how are they different for you in terms of what you have to bring?
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a great question. And if there's ever an opportunity for a follow-up, I'm sure that my answer on this is going to be much better after I've done 3 and 4, because, you know, part of being open to the kind of Cagean process is realizing I may have some expectations for, you know, and certainly for your operas 1 and 2, I had expectations going in, and the show was really different. And
I
you
see. I
know
see.
what I mean?
Okay, so it's an unfair question for the opera. It
And
was 2018 when Yuval did your operas 1 and 2 in Studio City, California, which is a little adjacent city in LA, in the greater LA area. He
yeah.
did it in a sound studio, Sony sound studio.
Yeah,
So
Sony
he
Studio.
did, and your operas 1 and 2 is from, as I say, I think it was composed between 85 and 88, and it premiered in Frankfurt. It's very little performed because it's so demanding and opera is so expensive that opera houses tend to really only want to do those things that they can guarantee that they'll get 80% of their opera audience back to see it. So they're shy about doing that.
Right. And it is big. I mean, the forces needed are pretty considerable. You know, your operas 1 needs 10 singers and your operas 2 needs 9 singers. So we're
Right.
talking about 19 singers, you know,
Just
solos,
singers, just singers.
just singers, and that's not even orchestra, right? And so and it is it, you know, it's scored for full orchestra, right? And
It's
so
small. It's a small orchestra. It's like a mo we say Mozart orchestra.
okay, sure. I remember we had a fairly large orchestra in LA, but yes, but I mean, you know, I mean, I think it was the size as designated in the score. In any case, your operas 3 and 4 is much more intimate, as I've started to realize. I'll say that I wanted to do it at Sony Picture Studios for a couple of reasons. I was thinking about the visual aspect of the Euro operas, not having seen the one in Frankfurt, but having read about the one in Frankfurt and also reading your incredible and indispensable dissertation
Thank
on
you.
your operas, which was my
We use
app.
it as a doorstop around here because it's
It's
so
not. It's not. And it reads so well. I mean, it really feels like having a conversation with you, which is
Oh,
so
nice.
remarkable for a dissertation, you know.
Nice.
So, but no, I learned a lot about Cage's wishes, some of which he was able to realize in Frankfurt, and some of which he was not able to realize, maybe partially because of the fire that burned down the.
Right. Yeah, so we ended up in a smaller theater. After all was said and done, we ended up in the Schauspielhaus, which was about, I don't know how much, like what percentage smaller, but it was significantly smaller than the main stage. Can you imagine? Block this whole thing, and then 1 week before you open, block it like this, you know?
But that seems like the ultimate Cagean exercise. I'm sure it like I somehow imagine that everyone just said, okay, so here we go. We're in a new space,
That's what we did. That's what we did.
right? And
It's
so,
true.
but I mean, in many ways, that's what you can so get from a from engaging with Cage. Is knowing that there is still a lot of flexibility. There's no improvisation, but there's a lot of needing to adjust to the circumstances. And you can't quite rely on things happening exactly the same way from one moment to another. And that keeps you really aware. And
Yeah, it's
because that
true.
awareness is the awareness is so high level for the singers, and it makes them more open, I think, to adjusting. I don't know if you remember, I talk about this with Meredith all the time, and in the songbooks, she took a little bit longer with one of her songs. We had these three little houses on the stage, and they all had like a curtain that would come
I
up.
remember it intimately,
Oh,
but go ahead. I loved it so much.
well, it was such a just kind of like a simple gesture, but I thought so much of the songbooks felt like there was an intimacy about it. And there was another Cage quote that I fell in love with, which is just like, where he describes us as kind of almost like snails that we carry our houses on our backs. You know
Oh,
what I mean?
yeah.
Carry ourselves with us. And so I thought these really simple and like Thoreau-like little cabins on the stage that we could put on and create kind of some different visuals. But because everyone had their own path, Meredith had to sing one song in one of the houses. And it was a more flexible in terms of the time it took. Like there was a start time, but there wasn't necessarily an end time to what she sang. And at one of the performances, she was just really connecting with the material in a way that made it longer than she was used to singing. The only problem was someone else was required, and on their timeline, at exactly this point in the timeline, to bring down the curtain on this house. And so they come around, it was one of the musicians from the symphony. They come around to the house and they flip the switch on the curtain, and Meredith is still singing, and the curtain is just coming down while she's still singing.
I
And
think I remember this.
yes, because it was so incredible to watch. At that point, I had gotten to know Meredith quite well through the process of rehearsing. And I felt like I saw a flicker across her eyes saying, should I dive under that curtain or what should I do? What should I do? But she stayed committed to her song, finished her song, and found her way out of that house somehow.
In the dark.
But to me, like, because the whole, that's the kind of thing that for a performer like Meredith, who is so, she really is such an exacting performer in so many ways. But engaging with Cage kind of forced her to accept the circumstances as they were. It says,
Right.
well, circumstances mean the curtain has come down on me. Literally has come down on
Right.
me in the middle of my singing. You know what? I'm going to keep going and I'll figure my way out of this house, out of this little house. It was
Right.
so moving. It was so moving because everyone did that, and it was also so moving to see the musician who didn't get out of the way because Meredith was still singing. He just said, oh, at the 18 minute and 30 second mark, I have to flip the switch on this and I do it, and
Right, which is exactly right,
exactly
because you it's a family, so you have to keep your place, you can't become dad just because you feel like it,
Exactly.
But I have questions for you. I have questions for you about, for example, we've touched on elements of this, but one of the things in your operas one and two at the premiere and at the PepsiCo Festival in New York. But I heard from Mark Swed, the music critic at the LA Times, who's a very big fan of Yuval and Yuval's work. when he came back from the Triennale, the Ruhrgebiet production by I always forget who did that, the director.
Heiner Goebbels.
Heiner Goebbels, exactly. And he came back and he said one of the things that he missed was that the staging was very German and very sort of blocked off and very tidy. And in the original production, so I'm going to tell this for our audience, but I'd love to know what's happening with you guys in Detroit. The stage, there's no backdrop to the stage. It's just the platform with all the grids, so everybody moves the way they know they're supposed to. And there are these flats that come in, very having to do, and I don't know if you're recycling flats or images from the Detroit Opera.
They are, yes, indeed.
You are. Yeah,
Yes.
excellent. Excellent.
But only for
There are
three
opera
actors.
singers and famous opera houses and blah, 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 whatever. But the other thing that happens is that because the back of the stage is open, you see the sets being moved, you see the people setting up costumes, clothes changes. You actually see the singers change their costumes. You see all the stuff in the background. You see the people who are make the opera possible, but are never on the stage. You never see them. And so there was some getting used to that. And by the end of it, you had a lot of those workers felt a real ownership of that work and the success of that work just because they were ex so exposed, you know.
I love that.
And it was beautiful. It was really
I thought
beautiful.
so. I thought so
And at
too.
first they resisted it because it embarrassed them.
Yeah, no, sure. Absolutely. Also because, it's hard to, yeah, it's hard to figure out your path in this as a crew member, right? Or as a, as somebody. So yeah, so I can imagine that was really tough. I mean, one thing that I noted when we did it, when we did one and two, and I can already sense that three and four is going to feel this way, is for me, there's such a feeling of liberation, not in the sense of a free for all, but just a sense of we are exploring all of this in a way that is so different from how we are always asked to think about this music. And I know that my cast in one and two, like they just had so much joy in the work. And it's kind of tricky because you don't want them to take too much joy in it. You shouldn't feel self-satisfied by any means, but you should be grounded in yourself and so confident in what it is that you're doing that that comes through as something beautiful to watch. That's part of the beauty of watching individuals who are just really in their own little encapsulated universe that find their way to stay out of everyone's way. You know what I mean? And to be,
I do, I do, I do.
And so for me, there's a joy about that. I probably, directing Cage is always such a fascinating thing because I don't do the things I normally do as a director, right? I don't use my prejudices about what will look good together, what is going to sound good together, what is going to, you know what I mean? Like
Yeah,
it's
sure.
much about, so much of my work is often about, my cultivated tastes being seen on stage. And this is the exact opposite. And every time I feel like, the task for me has been every time I've been tempted to say, oh, it would be really great is if something, and then I have to say, then don't do it. You know what I mean? Because
Right.
then I'm
Because,
doing the old thing, then I'm just doing the old opera thing, as opposed to letting things emerge and then being surprised by them and being things that happen that I would have never in a million years would have come up with myself. And I think
exactly.
that's
And they're fabulous,
and
you know.
they're so fabulous and endlessly joyous, for me. Like, and so I take joy in that process. And I think that probably, so it's not when it's me directing Cage versus Heiner Goebbels, for example, like I think Heiner Goebbels with his cultural background, with his level of, he's got a great sense of humor as a person, but he's also got a real level of kind of seriousness when he thinks about stage, even when they're a little more lighthearted, they're, he's German. Come on,
And
like,
I forgot what I was going to say, but what I want you to do, we should take this moment of me being like that to get you to tell our audiences about when this is coming up, where it's happening, all of
yes,
that stuff, and they want to
all the
come.
details.
You
Absolutely,
said there are tickets still available, so.
still available. And I mean, it is, to your point, this is such a rare opportunity, and I'm just so grateful to have this platform to be able to do the Cage, to introduce more people to Cage, and also to discover that Cage had such an incredible impact on people here in Detroit through all of his work in Cranbrook. And he's very well regarded in Detroit, you know. And when people hear that we're doing Cage, they couldn't believe it, because this is not the kind of stuff that the Detroit Opera was doing up until I
Exactly.
started.
Most opera companies, I can't tell you how long Peters has been out there, pushing for new productions of these stage songbooks among them
Oh, sure, sure,
for
sure.
orchestras, for opera companies could do
Absolutely.
magnificent things with the songbooks.
Oh, it's there's,
And
I mean, songbooks is like there's endless reiterations that can happen out of songbooks. So,
exactly,
absolutely.
because it's all unique. It's 96 if you count the four solos that were done later. 96 little things, little solo songs, little duets, little conceptual pieces, little things with theater, things without theater,
I
things
know.
with text, not with text.
Well,
You
I'm
can
dying to do
do.
it. I'm dying to do it again. And then quite honestly, after I did John Cage, the John Cage Year Operas 1 and 2, I really thought to myself, I have to do this every 5 or 6 years, because it just feels like a reset. You know what I mean? It just feels like every.
Sure.
So I'm just really grateful to have this chance here in Detroit to reintroduce audiences to Cage for people that don't know Cage. And this is going to be a big departure. And so I'm so fascinated to see how the audience, reacts to it. But 3 and 4 is a really great, I think, starting point for an audience that is probably going to have a wide range of exposure to Cage's ideas, because they're more intimate. So 1 and 2, has a expanse to it and has a grandeur about it.
It's 2.5 hours in
And
length.
June, yes, exactly. It's a commitment.
It's
Okay, so
long. It's a
it's
commitment.
a
It has a blimp that goes through it.
well,
It's got everything but the kitchen sink kind
I
of thing,
know.
feeling.
Exactly. And I have to say, thinking about your operas 1 and 2 and your operas 3 and 4 and then your operas 5, like when I think about that trajectory, I kind of feel like, and I'm sure this has been written about somewhere, but I kind of feel like what I get a sense of is that from that grandeur and all of that artifice and the joy in the artifice, right? And the joy of the old costumes and the old imagery that are thrown together and recombined in ways that something new emerges from them. There's something that happens that I think does begin in three, from 3 to 4, and I got to get to 5 now because I've got to complete this cycle. But I think something happens where it just feels like they're narrowing in, like they're kind of zeroing in, like as if Cage is really trying to get to the essence of what makes opera so special and so beautiful. Like that the idea that there's less and less performers. More like, but 4 for me, I think what the audience will see is 3 is going to still have a lot of the same ideas from your operas 1 and 2, meaning lots of costume changes. Every aria will have a different costume, lots of set pieces taken from the archives of the Detroit Opera from all kinds of various productions. A lot of lighting, like ton, like there's, I think the call is for so many lighting cues, which took us a long time to decipher how we're going to do it in this case. But nonetheless, just it has a busyness to it and a sense, I'm guessing. I mean, I will see what happens when everything falls into place. But based on the instructions, you get a sense that there is a kind of a slightly more of a circus quality to 3, potentially. Less than 1 and 2, but still with some of those aspects. And then when you get to 4 and you're suddenly with 2 singers as opposed to 6, and 1 pianist as opposed to 2, and one of the Liszt transcriptions played in full as opposed to lots of little excerpts of Liszt, there is a sense of concentration. Also, I think the instructions are so poetic, because the instructions imply that the lighting is meant to be indirect as opposed to kind of harsh theater, like not harsh, but like the kind of theater lighting that does emphasize an artificiality and art, as if it's a light installation, really. You know what I mean? On its and it's that the light has its own quality, but the instructions in 4 are so beautiful because it implies that there's no direct lighting, like as if the lights are supposed to be bouncing from all over. And this incredible sound file from your operas 1 and 2 is used again, Truckera, the kind of electronic compilation of all of these recorded operas happening at the same. But I was going to say, with Truckera, for example, in your operas 3, you are instructed to use Truckera the same way that that we used them for one and two, which is, it's moving through the space and, it's meant to, as if it's obliterating all other sound for that brief moment that it appears. But the instructions for your operas four implies that Trucker is happening in some other room, like as if it's happening off site, and so you just get this feeling like the, as if the circus is kind of leaving town. You know what I mean? Like the music's going
Interesting.
away, the lights are going away, and you're left with a much more intimate, there's no costume changes for us for your operas four. They're going to be in a kind of concert attire, so it's kind of getting closer to almost like a recital format. And when I read the instructions for five, although I haven't studied them in great depth, I get the sense that it goes even one step further into like even let the circus is even further down the street. You know what I mean? So it's kind of
It's
like,
probably in the next town.
right? Yes, it's already set up shop in another town, and you hear distant echoes of it. But that's it, and I just find that a beautiful trajectory. Thinking about these pieces happening, towards the end of Cage's life, and thinking about opera and theater and the act of representation and like the density, as if the de I mean the density will naturally kind of slow down, as soon as you have fewer voices. And so
But he was, as you say, he himself was aging. He was slowing down. He was getting thinner as a person, and he died not so long after he completed your upper five. It wasn't so long. But we're going to run out of time. And I just want to say to you, but I also want people to know how special this is that Cage conceived of your operas one and two, three and four by extension, and five further extension, but really one and two. Were con he conceived of them as an opera that should be totally recycled, that should be this score should be made up of snippets from the opera scores that the opera house has in its archives. It should use costumes that are out there in the costume department. Everything should be recycled. And Cage found, at least with Frankfurt, big resistance to that because. Because they were celebrating the incoming of a new director, conductor, Gary Bertini. All of a sudden we have, oh yes, Mr. Bertini, yes, we're so pleased. Oh no, we don't need any new fancy orchestra or this or that. We're gonna use all the parts we have. And oh no, it's not conducted. It's just Cage doesn't write music that's conducted. It's like everything was being taken away from what usually happens when a new person comes in. You do the most lavish production of something, and everything's new and the most famous designer and all of that.
Oh,
He
totally.
conceived of it just the opposite, that he wanted it to pe that opera houses to he wanted Andy Culver to actually make a program that would come with a little book about how to produce your operas, and it would have chance determined, I mean, chance programming that would let you input all your lighting apparatus that you had in place. And now you're going to subject chance to that to say what your lights are going to be. And you're coming the closest I've seen to this in this production in Detroit at the Little Gem Theater
At the
on
Little
what dates?
Gem Theater, March 8th, 9th, and 10th, three performances. And yeah, we chose the Little Gem. I mean, actually, I went around Detroit looking for the perfect theater for this because we have a 2,700 seat theater here in Detroit, appropriate for one and two. Maybe we'll get to one and two one day. But way too big for three and four, where I just
Of
want.
course, of course.
So we found this magnificent little jewel box of a theater that is over 100 years old. It's been newly renovated, but now is kind of an event space for weddings and corporate events and the like. And they haven't had a public performance there in over a decade, actually. So this is kind of an amazing, also revivification of this space through the Your Operas, and feels totally totally right.
Nice, 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 nice.
So it's a beautiful little.
We have to stop.
Oh dear.
We have
Well.
like 10 seconds. We don't, I mean, we're not, we go, I make this stuff up.
Well, no, but that's also very Cajunist to say that's the time
we're
we were
time.
allotted. That's the time we were allotted, and we will now honor
That's
the
right.
time.
Our program is supposed to be 58 minutes, and we've just finished 52, which is going to leave me time to do get your introduction and station ID and all that. The more I think about this, Yuval, I think number one, I'll see you in Detroit. I'm
Can't wait.
thrilled. I can't
Can't
wait.
wait. I am so excited, Laura.
But I'm wondering if you will consider coming back when this is all over.
I would love to.
Because I'd love to hear your impressions. I think that, as I said, you are, if not in, if you not unique, but so really alone in being a person who has produced one and two, and now you're doing three and four. And I guarantee you're going to do five. There's
Oh,
no doubt
yeah.
in my mind.
I'm already hatching a scheme
So
to
you, I think you will. I think that you have not a theoretical overview about the poetics of these three works, but are a very real sort of take on the landscape of these three works relative to Cage. And I think that's really marvelous. I'd love to poke around that topic
good.
with
Let's
you
keep
more.
exploring. Certainly after I've done three and four, so I can feel what it's like from inside three and four, which,
Exactly.
I have ideas for what it might feel like, but just as I've asked everybody that's participating in it to get rid of all their expectations and come with an open mind, I'm also coming in with a total open mind, and we will
I
see what
exactly.
emerges from the circumstances, of these
Well, I
particular.
can't wait. I can't wait.
Thank you. Can't wait either, Laura. Thank you
Okay, so I'll
for
see you in just a couple of weeks, March 8, 9, 10, three performance only at the Little Gem Theater in Detroit, downtown Detroit. And they're having hardly any winter. So nobody
No
has to worry
kidding.
about, 50 feet of snow, which used to
No.
be the case in Detroit in the winter.
No kidding. It's quite, to maybe as a brief, you might have to cut this off. I totally get it. But I just will say that the recycling thing, I mean, I have to say that it's so remarkable to do a piece that wants everything to be recycled, because here we are, we're in this incredibly uncomfortable warmth of like a winter that is really making us aware of our impact on this planet and our
Having
responsibility.
everything to do with consumption, the opposite of recycling, and there was Cage in
Right.
the end of his life making a work that he wanted. He didn't want anything new, really. He just wanted you to use what you had in the
Exactly.
most beautiful way,
I so agree. And so that kind of environmental approach to the recycling, the notion of ecology and care for what's there, that things are not just meant for single use, that things should be
Exactly.
reused, repurposed, because within anything, there are so many possibilities and there's so much potential. And that's,
Yes.
I would love if that becomes one of the ideas that people meditate on over the course of the year operas,
Wouldn't that be beautiful? Yeah, and the other part of it, is that in that recycling, that kind of recycling, which is internal, it's use what you have,
Yes, indeed.
means that, and having a computer program that you subject your own things to chance means inevitably that there is no repetition, that every iteration of your operas one and two would be different, very different
Oh,
from
totally.
each other, because you would be using your own materials from your own backyard, your own house, I
Exactly.
love it. I love it. He was so
I
brilliant.
love it so much. That's why I said after I did one and two, I was like, I have to do this every 5 or 6 years just to, because I know it won't ever be the same. It's not
Exactly.
like it will not be like reviving a production I've done before. It will be like starting all over again. It'll be
Right.
just.
And it also it works against the idea of a masterpiece in the sense that there's no best production except
No.
for devotion and care. It isn't
Exactly.
about, isn't that wonderful?
It brings me close. I remember with one and two, it brought me close to why I love opera in the first place. Like in a way that, was sometimes you get kind of inundated with the everyday quality of producing and et cetera, and you're so caught up in your own ideas of what opera is
Right.
supposed to be. And then
Right.
suddenly you do this, all those ideas are blown out of the water, and you feel like you are like a newborn,
Yeah,
It's really special. So can't wait for
it's
that.
been great to be with you, Yuval. I can't wait to see you and your work.
Thank you.
Let's be sure to get back together again and continue this because there's so much more to talk about. I would love just to talk about your past work and not past. It's not so past. You're such a baby. So your work just a few years ago, you were doing X, Y, and Z. But there's so many things I'd love to talk with you about. So.
It would be fun to talk about also the piece I'm doing in LA with George Lewis, because it also feels inspired by the year operas. It's a new piece by George Lewis and Monteverdi's Coronation of Poppaea happening simultaneously on a turntable. Like this one piece on one side of a turntable and the other one on another side of the turntable, but they're happening simultaneously. And
Who does work on a turntable, you crazy man?
actually, a lot of people in Germany, to be honest.
Oh,
But I
okay,
do love
fine,
anyway, but well,
fine.
let's that could be something because it really grew out of the experience doing the year operas, you know, like thinking about is there could I take some of these tactics and apply them in a new in a different way, you know?
Yeah,
And
yeah.
with some intentionality. What happens if we add some intentionality to this? Does it ruin the whole thing or can another idea emerge, you
No,
know?
but see, that's going back. This is a good way to close because that's Michael Tilson Thomas, this festival, making the right choices. It's like, what are you going to pick and choose? Because so much of it is indeterminate in its outcome. So making the right choices is really important, really important.
That was so true. Okay, my dear. Great to see
Okay,
you.
see you soon.
Thank you so much. Love being with you.
Thank you, Yuval. I feel the same about you.
Thanks, Laura.
Bye.
Bye.